This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.
The Podcast Studios is the home of the Head Stuff Podcast Network. It's where lots of our shows are recorded, and we work on editing, promotion, videos, live shows, and lots more. As a podcast production company with three state-of-the-art studios for audio and video in Dublin City Centre, we can work with you to tell great stories in a professional and engaging way. From government organisations to charities, arts groups to international brands, entrepreneurs to hobbyists, we've worked with everybody and we can help you to get the word out. Whether you need studio time, you're hosting a live stream or webinar, or you need support with editing or marketing, we can tailor a package for you. For more info, head to thepodcaststudios.ie.
Welcome back to F&I Rap Chat. It's Carla again. Thanks for coming with me on my journey to learn everything I can about animation in Ireland. I'm here with the right man today, Steve Woods, director and owner of Cell Division. He also teaches animation. We talk education. We talk about the history of animation in Ireland and a little about Steve's upcoming book, Drawing the Line. I'm so very lucky to have Steve here with me today. I hope you learned as much from him as I did in the last hour. To follow me along on my journey through animation, you can follow us here on F&I Rap Chat. You can follow along on YouTube, Spotify, Headstuff Plus, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. If you love what we do here, please consider supporting us at buymeacoffee.com/F&I. Hello, Steve.
Hiya, Clara.
Hello. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to me today.
It's a pleasure.
I was absolutely delighted to get you because you are one of the most interesting people I have ever met. Okay. Not just in regards to animation, in regards to your whole spiderweb of stuff that you do.
I know this is a podcast, but I'm blushing, everybody.
Oh,
I'm going red.
So pink. Oh, it's just so nice to have people come in and say yes to us because you have a wealth of knowledge to share. So we're going to dig into that.
Yeah, that's because I'm old.
It's because you've aged like fine wine.
Thank you.
I would say. So tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you get here?
Yeah, I got interested in animation when there was very little of it going on, actually. And I had a bit of a background drawing cartoons for the odd left-wing paper stuff. And I realized that I did about 12 a year and you couldn't make a living on that. But I moved into an apartment with a guy called Declan Quinn, actually, who's got a career in Hollywood now. And his wife, Etta, was very interested in animation and she wanted to make some animation. So we rigged up a rostrum camera. I just helped Declan make a rostrum camera for 16mm film rostrum camera. And we were going to shoot this project Etta had, and she became pregnant and gave up on the idea. So we had this rostrum camera, so I thought I'd give it a shot. And when I shot some animation, cut-out paper animation. And when I did that, I saw it move, playback. Declan also had loads of gear. He had some editing equipment. He had a 35mm camera and he had a projector. So when I played it back on the projector, I saw the pictures move and that was it, caught the bug and I wanted to stay with it. And at the time, there was a guy called Harry Hess, who was a sort of a very interesting early kind of pioneer in the middle of in the early days of animation. And he set up a course in NCAD in Thomas Street there, where he did an animation module for graphic students. And in the evening, he did an animation course. So I did that. So very basic stuff. And from that, I set up a studio with two ex-students of Harry's, and started dabbling doing corporate kind of videos back then. But there was no computer, so you know, if you want to do a pie chart, someone had to sort of animate it. And I could do that much animation. I learned the job, and then I went to Annecy, where I saw animated films, and I saw the whole competition and the people really serious into animation. And I said, listen, I think I'll try and make a film, and I did. And that got me into RTE, and I worked a year in RTE doing stings for a children's show, which is how a lot of people started. And or not a lot, but you know, you could get a start that way. And that was basically it. That's how I got kicked into animation, you know. There wasn't much animation around at the time, you know. You had Jimmy Murakami had a studio that made ads mostly for Europe, but he made one or two Irish ads too. In Irish Town, you know, he started off in Sandy Mount, he went to Dundrum, and then he ended up in Irish Town. And there was Aidan Hickey, who was doing good RTE work, and there was the granddaddies of them all, the Quinn films, James Quinn, and later his son, who was a teacher of yours. I'm so bad at names, I just can't believe I've forgotten
David
Quinn's name. Jeez. Anyway, David, who's a friend of mine, is took over the reins there, and so that was one of the oldest studios, you know, and this was all just before the Americans kicked off, you know.
Okay. You work in experimental animation.
Yes, he says hesitantly.
Yeah, you're interested in it. You teach it. What
yeah,
is it?
The word experimental animation, experimental film. I suppose you could say it's non-narrative. That's one part of it. I'm not that interested in getting narrative out so much. And the other side that people talk about, you know, experimental animation, is also the styles you work in. So, and that's what most people mean by it. And that's what I teach in Dunleary College now, in the National Film School in IADT. And it's all the early forms of animation were never thrown out. They still are in the toolbox of animation. So unlike live action, if live action, they invent something new, like talkies was a classic example of it. Silent movies, nobody makes a silent movie anymore, and certainly don't make it in black and white, and they don't square off the image or do anything like that. They always try to be contemporary and up to speed and all that kind of stuff. Whereas with animators, anything that new that came along, that's great, but we kept the old stuff as well. Mm-hmm. So people still make films like Gertie the Dinosaur was made in 1914, 15 or 16, whichever, which is single level. You draw the background, you draw the character and all the animation and everything on one piece of paper. And when you draw the next piece of paper, you draw the background, the action, the character and everything. And it animates as you go along. That's a very old style, and people still work on that. And that's called experimental. And working on sand, if you Google sand animation, you get people making illustrations with sand. But I'm talking about making the sand move. And that's very, very suitable to abstract work. Mm. So a lot of experimental work done in sand is actually abstract animation, which again is a sort of experimental work and often non-narrative. And then there's great pioneers like Norman McLaren, who scratched directly onto film, lovely shapes. And you're looking at sort of modern art come alive, you know. So that's what people mean by experimental work. But you can use all those alternatives, like direct onto film, single level, paper cutouts, sand, pixelation, particularly pixelation where you move people. All of that stuff can be narrative or non-narrative. So whereas usually when you talk about experimental work, you tend to be talking about abstract work and stuff like that in fine arts. And there's, you know, fine art videos that you'd see in a white space gallery, they tend to be, what makes them experimental is they're non-craft.
Right.
So it's somebody with an out of focus video jumping up and down the trampoline saying, talking about, you know, this is their, I'm trying to examine my identity in the landscape or whatever, you know, they're trying to say. And whereas what I'm talking about, experimental animation that I teach and that I try to do is craft-based. So it has a structure, it has an edit, it has, you know, one scene following another scene. Mm. So there is a structure to it, even if it's not narrative. Yeah.
Okay, really interesting. Thank you. So you've been around the block. That's how you got
two or three times.
So much knowledge. What are some of the biggest changes you've seen in animation in Ireland over the years?
Well, two come to mind. One would be that we kind of started off in a classic European mode, you know.
Yeah, it small looks like little Disney.
Yes. Yeah. One even looks like Disney. It's like, you know, like James Quinn down in Tipperary with Quinn Films, they were making model animation. That's kind of a classic way for animators in Europe to get in, you know, because it's small, you can rig it up like a little live action camera set. So if you've got camera live action background, you can apply yourself to animation, but you just have to remove the wooden models and puppets very carefully. And then, you know, myself, I was into cutout animation, which I loved. Aidan Hickey was, you know, the grandfather of cutout animation in Ireland, so he developed a relationship with RTE. So what we were doing was we were following a pattern in Europe, small little studios doing their own things, cottage-like industries. And so the big change that happened, and because I was there when that was happening, was the Americans arrived. And so we suddenly got Hollywood big studios. Mm. And that didn't happen anywhere else in Europe. You know, that was really, really, I mean, yes, there were big studios in France and one or two other places. But the way they came at us with the whole American thing, and it was duplicated in the colleges because the colleges started teaching American animation through Sheridan, the course that Sheridan College in Canada developed, which Ballyfermot bought in, and then ex-students of Ballyfermot brought to other colleges. So that's one of the big things, the movement from, or not the total abandonment, but there's still people doing small college-like stuff, and that's great, but also this awareness of big studios and how to operate them. That was a very, very sudden change and kind of out of kilter and kind of shouldn't have happened, you know? Mm. And then the other one was not long after that was the move from film to digital. And so I'm old enough to remember. I learned how to load a camera and learned to focus and rig a camera up for animation and light it and all. Not that there's much to do lighting it, but, you know. And then digital came in and suddenly you didn't have to edit on an editing bench and you didn't have to worry about footage, and then video assist kicked in so you could play back what you just shot. And, you know, you couldn't do that back in the day when I started. There used to be a lab in RTE for 16mm reversal film, which means you didn't use a negative, you shot on a positive stock, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And then they'd develop it, so you'd go in and you just crossed your fingers and hope you didn't make a mistake, and it'd come out as a positive piece. Yeah, and you looked at it and you went, yeah, that's good enough to go on air.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty hairy.
What stayed the same?
I think what stayed the same or even got better was our sense of, well, certainly our sense of storytelling, which is slow to develop scripting, you know. Scripting for pictures is really so hard.
Yeah.
We have this tradition of storytelling, which doesn't really, you know, making film is making a story with pictures, it's not telling a story with words. And so we had to fight this wonderful storytelling tradition we have, which is actually a strength, but it gets in the way a bit. And also our literary tradition, which is like, you know, James Joyce writing the great Irish novel, which, you know, people were really doing when they were writing a script, they were writing a novel, or a play, because we have a tradition in that, of course. And slowly, and we're still doing it, we're still trying to learn good scripting, but I mean, from where it began, with the first film board, which closed down when did it close down, 87, 88 or something. And then it started again. We had to start all over again. And scripting only started kicking in the last 15 years, I think. Good scripts.
Mm.
As for animation itself, even though, you know, you don't use paper, you really do have to learn on paper with a pencil, and you have to learn some basic animation principle ideas. I think we're getting a bit staid at it. You know, we're still teaching the Sheridan course, which is, you know, all well and good, and the principles are the principles, and they'll always be the principle. A two-legged walk is going to be a two-legged walk.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there can be, this should be more panache to it, more imagination to it as well.
Okay.
You know, feeding imagination as well as the principles, which is in the last 3 or 4 years is a turn which has happened in IADT. They're trying to emphasize the creative as well as the boot camp kind of work.
Yeah.
That's under David Quinn, whose name I remembered this time. David's pushing that quite strong there.
Great. So You still have to learn your bouncing ball.
You still have to learn your bouncing ball. You still best worth start with a pencil and paper. Mm-hmm. Even though we're all going paperless, it's still the best way to start.
Yeah. Okay. Good stuff. So we actually had a chat before this and you wrote a book.
Well, that's right, yeah.
So one of my questions I have here is, why do you think animation flourished in Ireland? And I feel like you might be the best person to answer this question.
Yeah. Well, I kind of knew about this before I wrote the book, although the book certainly kind of reinforces it, that we had this, I think animation, there was a number of things came together. The American studios arriving was a big deal. And it learned, you know, we learned how to make a bit feature films. And even if we didn't want to make a feature film, we had that in our heads. I mean, it wasn't a mystery. That was one thing. The other thing was the colleges picked up on it and started teaching animation, first diploma courses, then degree courses. And to a very good standard, and again, with a very strong American influence. And then another thing would have been the Tiger economy. You know, so many people like that, especially when the studios sunk, they would have, and many did, go to Phoenix, Arizona, with followed Don Bluth over there. And there was already a little residue of people there in L.A., and Brian Woods and Karen Hamrock. I can't remember Karen's partner now. God, he'll kick me when if he hears this and I don't mention his name. And, of course, Richie Bainham, was, the famous Richie, they were already there, too. So there would have been more immigration from Ireland, but because of the Celtic time, people stayed. And it wasn't easy. That sounds like it was easy. There was money pouring in. It wasn't. You know, just setting up a business is really hard, and most businesses don't survive 2 years. So it was, I think, one of the reasons why they survived was because they were young. There's so many young people kicking off, and they didn't know what failure was and didn't care. And, you know, they could live next to nothing for years, you know. I know that for sure, that all the CEOs who set up all started off, you know, working in their bedrooms or paying people and not paying themselves, you know. And somehow it was youth and youthful enthusiasm, which with a growing economy, with an educated background, and with some, you know, some people saying, oh yeah, didn't they make feature films? Oh yeah, maybe they should. Oh, they're still making feature films. Or, you know, and there was a few feature films getting made or produced anyway. You know, Terry Gliff was doing a few with Paul Bulger, and there were big long form series getting done in Shepherd with Jimmy Murakami and Michael Alger. So they were all the residue, if you like, if you can put it like that, from that survived the collapse of the big studios and decided, look, we've got something here, we can keep it going. Which was very, very courageous of them. And they stuck it through, you know. I'm trying to drag names out. I'm just so bad at names. You remember that when I was a student, when you were a student and I was your teacher and trying to struggle with names. But the thing of it is that they all pulled through, and there were a lot of young people coming through with who developed slowly but surely skills, and they grew up with the industry too. They grew up with the digital crossover, which was no big for me. It was heartbreaking when we changed from film, you know? But for them, they didn't care less. And also with the rise of computer work, you know, and thinking of Brand Bag, you know, how they very quickly upped the ante with their computer work and started producing really high quality work that then became, people were beating a track from LA to work with them, you know. So yeah, the success story is the educational background, the American influence, the Tiger economy, even though, you know, the Tiger economy collapsed, but for the most part, the animation industry didn't. It kept thriving, you know.
So it was the perfect storm, the right people, the right time.
Yeah. And it was a perfect storm, yeah, which still has a strong effect now. You know, even COVID, you know, the animation company seems to be going through, working its way through that, and became COVID proof, recession proof. Hopefully it'll be artificial intelligence proof as well.
Yeah, hopefully. I think we'll be okay. We have a long legacy of coping quite well with adversity in Ireland, so I'm hoping.
Yeah, when I was writing the book, I remember Mark Cumberland said this kind of argument about, you know, new technology has been as old as the as old as the Stone Age, he said they were fighting over, you know, should you make a picture with your finger or should you use this newfangled stick, you know? So
that's right. I said to you before, the man on the street with the bell ringing at the end is here. Happened in 3D, happened when we went digital. It's always going to happen.
Yeah, so there'll always be people saying it's the end of the world. Yeah,
that's true. That's very true. So I might just ask you about the book now. Please tell me some more. It sounds so interesting.
Yeah, I finished the book in March. It may be printed next March. It's with an agent at the moment who's trying to get a company for it to publish it. Hopefully he will.
What's it about?
It's kind of a personal story about animation. I did try to make it into an academic kind of tome at one point. I thought this would be the go-to place for anybody who wanted to know anything about animation. And in the end, I sort of fell back on my own, I suppose, storytelling and just made it more of a personal story. And indeed, I think there's quite a few gaps in it. I shouldn't say that because I want people to think they're buying the definitive history. But it's not so that there's gaps, but I do touch on things, and I hope that some students and ex-students will go, oh, you know, what did he mean by that? And who were they? I'll check that out, you know, and you could have another little, you know, magazine article at the very least, or a thesis or something from some of the questions that are left hanging in the book. But the book starts with... it starts with animation in Ireland from James Horgan, who experimented in animation just after the First World War, and which was very, very early on in animation. And then I explain where animation is and where it comes from. Mm-hmm. And I talk about that it predates cinema, and just by a few years, but it does. And then how, you know, the whole problem of kicking into a film industry, setting up an animation industry in the 50s and 60s in Ireland was really hard, but so it was for live action as well. There was a kind of a fear by government to establish a film industry because film reflects society and they didn't want anything bad. this state was founded by a cultural revival where people put plays on and saying, isn't, you know, Britain wicked and why don't we have our own country? And they were afraid that they would put up films saying, isn't the government wicked and let's have a new government or let's, you know, go socialist or something like that. So they were very, very heavy-handed about that. And when they did open Ardmore, they tended to want foreign companies to come there and we'd service them. And if anything Irish was done, it was usually Irish, you know, it was usually...
out on the West Coast in a tunnel
And the main actor would be English and stuff like that, you know, and some of them were good, like some of them were good, and they certainly trained up great craftspeople and you know, camera crews and costume departments and makeup departments, all of those were really great, came out of it. But what really kicked animation and made the government say, listen, we've got to do something, is TV. They had to launch a TV, and we were one of the last countries in Europe to do it, and I think that's because they were afraid of it. And then when they got animation in, when they got TV in, they had to have animation somehow. And so they fed out small jobs to like James Quinn and Quinn Films or Aidan Hickey. And even I'd been one of those people, last people maybe to come to the table of those independents. But I got some work from them. And in the meantime, animation then took off. You know, just we went to bed one night and there was like six animators working in Ireland. We woke up and there's 360, you know, and then Sullivan Bluett suddenly appeared. So and that that's covered very strongly, and how we survived after that failure is very strong in it as well in the book. So there's a chapter about pre-America and the early people stepping up, you know, and then the American studios and then the survivors, and that would be Brown Bag. There are two people who sort of, there were the big studios like Monster and Monster Productions and Shepherd and Terry Glyph. They were the three big studios, and Paul Bulger's studio down in his name escapes me, I'm sorry, down in Dunleary, Dagda Films, and they kind of all came out of and survived in Bluith. But then some new independent type people were coming through, and the two that stand out would be Brown Bag Films by Cathal Gaffney and Dara O'Connell, you know, who they were some of those people who really sweated blood to get that studio off the ground. And Bob Cullen, isn't it? Bob Cullen of Boulder. So he, and with Anne Tweedy and people like that, formed Boulder Media. And from those two studios, particularly, an awful lot of people went in and out of Brown Bag, because it was more of an independent place and it was more you could get in and get out of. And they were basically saying, God, I like what these guys are doing. Maybe we could do something like that too. I think Robert Cullen actually worked in Brown Bag for a little bit as well. But so they kind of spawned off some work, you know, or some kind of inspiration to maybe we should go out ourselves and do stuff. Yeah, that entrepreneurial quality of trying to set up your own studio, I think, was really part of the reason why we were successful as well, you know. Mm. We weren't just sitting around waiting for service work to come in or I'm just here so I can go and get a better job in LA, you know. People stayed, you know, people, loads of people. You had Paul McGowan, like, he stuck it out, and Andrew Kavanagh and all the Brown Bag people, and not the Brown Bag people, Cartoons and Balloon people, you know, they all decided they were going to stick it out and here, you know, and it wasn't always easy, you know.
Mm. What do you think it is about the craft of animation that draws in these passionate people who work for nothing and are really driven to start their own studios? Do you think it's something in the craft or is it in the people?
Yeah, I think it's something in the craft, on maybe the people too, but certainly the craft, and they don't work for nothing anymore. Just emphasizing that very strongly. Yeah, there's something about the craft. It's such an exact, and, you know, I like to compare animation like poetry, and that live action is like novel writing. You know, it's distilled. It's got a very deep passion to it. Even if you see live action directors who started in animation, you can see that, like, you know, Terry Gilliam, you know, in Brazil, or Tim Burton, you know, who did, mm-hmm, Edward Scissorhands. Those kind of films, you know, when you say, you know, they were done by animation directors or people who cut their teeth in animation, you get, oh yeah, because it's got that richness to it.
Mm.
And there's just something about that, you know, that you know, and just the handcraft that, you know, that you're also very often, as you're an animator and you're learning to animate, you're learning to act a bit, you know, because you have to put that personality into the drawing, and you're learning to be a director because, you know, well, what's going to happen in the next scene.
Mm.
Or you're also learning to be an editor because you're going, well, that's too much of that, and I'll cut that back and do less of that, and I'll do more in the other scene. So you're thinking like an editor, a filmmaker, you know, a camera person, an actor, and costume designer, because you're gonna design them up and color them, you know. Mm. Art direction, all that stuff. You're kind of one man band in that respect, and you don't departmentalize yourself. I mean, you do eventually. A lot of people decide, I'm just going to do backgrounds, or I'm just going to do special effects and computers or something. But basically, you start off as a sort of a one man band or one woman band, and I don't think they think about that in live action, you know. So I think there is something about the craft that makes you very passionate about it and more involved, maybe more crazy about it than live action. And just the thought comes to my mind about live action. You know, live action and animation is converging so much too, that a lot of live action is taking the lead from animators because they're much more exact about the choreography in a scene, or mm-hmm, the weight and movement and timing in a scene, you know. So CGI piece of animation is great, but, you know, but it has to be operated by an animator, you mm-hmm know. So an awful lot of live action is CGI work, but really it doesn't work unless an animator has it, because they can see the bigger picture, and then you're like assistant director, that's their little bag, that animated world that they've created, that computer generated world that they've created, and that volcano in it that's going to blow, and they'll look after that. Then the director, the live action director, will go, oh no, it's great, and they'll go, no, it's not great, because, you know, those boulders aren't falling the right way. I'm going to make them fall the right way. Mm. That's my animator coming at me. And so they go, yeah, whatever. You know, so they back off. So an awful lot of special effects animation is ruling the roost in live action, I think. And there's a convergence. Live action is coming over to animation.
Yeah, I'd never,
you know, Avatar
about
and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's like
back to Richie Mayhem.
CGI is deeply crafted, the way that 2D and 3D animation is.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
every frame of painting kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
On.
Yeah. And well, there you go. Every frame of painting is, yeah, it's kind of a guide in animation that makes it very intense and more. I'm going to say more poetic than live action.
Mm. Okay. Thank you for that. Then my next question is: you sat down, you wrote a book, right? You're great at concentrating because you're in animation, and you kind of have
yeah,
to be good
point
at that, right? Was it hard to go from writing scripts to writing a novel?
No, I didn't write a novel.
Oh, you didn't write a novel?
It wasn't a personal story in that respect. It's actually a history of animation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But did you struggle with that?
No, I don't think I did, actually.
Okay, good.
I knew there was a narrative, beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of anecdotes to talk about, so I could write them up. Yeah,
mm.
Yeah. No, it's not a novel of animation. Who killed who?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was a mystery.
Or fantasy.
Yeah.
Science fiction. That's brutal. All animation is science fiction anyway.
That's true. That's very true. And would you approach writing this long form prose historical content the same way you would approach a script? Do you go in with a structure and fill it out, or did you start at the beginning and just write?
Yeah, no, there was. I had a structure, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I sort of wrote down the contents page, and that became the structure.
Mm.
And yeah, and you try to carry the one chapter onto the next chapter.
Mm.
And yeah, the writing skills of writing scripts definitely helped, yeah.
Yeah, good.
Mm.
Good. Sorry. Is there anything you want me to ask about the book? Sorry. Sorry, I just want to put the book stuff.
Yeah, no, the...
Thank you. Thank you.
Sorry?
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot David Quinn's number and stumbled over that.
Yeah.
If you can make that tidier. Not the first time I mentioned him, not the last time about education.
Yeah, are you okay? Do you want a sup of water?
No, I've been supping the water. Whoops. I've been supping the water away there, yeah.
Very good. So, okay, there's lots of book stuff. Is there anything you really want me to ask about that you'd like to go off on?
Yeah, there was something there that I was leaving out. Oh yeah, education. We never really touched on education.
Education, yeah. Yeah. If you want, I can go on to the education part now. I just wanted to give you a chance to talk about the book, you know, if you wanted to. Okay,
well, one of the things in the book actually also covered wasn't just... you know, the blah, blah, blah account of studios coming along and setting themselves up and the success story of that. And I also want to include a chapter on education because, I alluded to earlier, it was very important in the success story of animation.
That's my next question.
Okay.
So will we go again?
Yes.
You sure you're ready?
Yes.
Fantastic. You're doing so good. I'm having such a good time. Okay, thank you. So what are some of the changes you've seen in animation education in Ireland over the years? And how does that play into where we got to now?
In education?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you were saying, the perfect storm. It came at the right time, you know, when the big studios were there trying to train up Irish people to take over the jobs that many of the Americans started with in the big studios. They got a really great education system in. It was Jerome Morrissey and Ballyfermot got the Sheridan course in, and with a lot of good tutors around them, they developed a very, very good course. Not just in the basic animation principles, but also in visual language, which Thelma Chambers had a lot to do with, and also in life drawing, which is so important in animation, which Laura Venerables had a lot to do with in the initial stages in Ballyfermot. She now works with me down in Dunleary. But you know, I remember working, you know, coming across animation people in Britain and stuff, and they just didn't know what we were doing, you know, like you know, working with blue pencils and drawing circles up and planning the movement in a certain way. They didn't get that in art colleges in England, you know. They didn't get that American style. So because we had the American education system from Sheridan, we actually stole a bit of a march on most of the Europeans, you know.
Okay.
And the British. And that sort of spread out then towards Doolig and the National Film School in Dunleary. And now there's other courses in Letterkenny and TUS Athlone in Limerick, Clonmel. There's three campuses do animation and Trinidad was a bit, and then there's a few private places like Pulse. So there's a lot of animation been taught in Ireland. So also up in Belfast, of course, where they actually have an MA in it as well. They're developing an MA in Dunleary as we speak. There's a real part of the strength of it is the animation course that it developed very, very well. There was money put into it, you know.
Mm.
And, Jerome Morrissey raised the money and put great amount of money and good teachers and the student. Carl Gaffney says that one of the reasons why those first 3 years, who I refer to as the specials, the Ballyfermot specials, because so many of them became CEOs or did so much work or got nominated for Oscars or all sorts of things, that they weren't just taught this wonderful course from Sheridan College, which was unique in outside Europe. outside America, and it was unique in Europe. They were also taught by practitioners down in the, you know, the couple of animators said, yeah, I'd like to do a bit of teaching. So they came out hot from their animation desks and came up and taught those guys. And, you know, when Garrett Lee got into Ballyfermot, he redeveloped, you know, now he wanted to bring something of that back. So he developed an industrial hub and skill nets and all that kind of stuff. But he also developed a link with the alumni from those years to come back and interact with the students, you know. And I think that's a really important thing, that the students realize that the sort of the people that they might look up to, you know, the Carol Gaffneys of this world, the Richie Bainhams and all that, were just, you know, snotty little gets like them, you know, at the college just a few years ago. Because I was there, I was teaching them, you know, and, you know, the every year that comes in just looks like the last year, you know, and they all have the same quality, you know, and they all could become as famous or as great if they wish to. In fact, there's a tremendous, in the last 6 or 7 years in Dunleary, and I can only speak for Dunleary, I'm sure it's, No, I've done a bit of external work in Limerick this year, and I saw some really, really good course, very talented people there, that really talented people have been attracted to animation now. Really gifted artists and already half-baked animators. You know, they've done a bit of it already online and stuff, which you wouldn't see 10, 15, 20 years ago. And they're making us look good, and we're getting exceptionally talented people, you know. People like Tom Moore, you know, back in the day, like we're getting 3 or 4 Tom. This is what they don't know. They don't realize they're as good as Tom. And Tom's a really nice guy, and I'm sure he'd agree that we're getting people coming in as talented as him now by the 3 or 4, you know. And it's just means that, you know, this wonderful thing that's happening is going to continue, you know.
Yeah. It stands to the quality of the education in this country that it's attracting such talented people, but where do they develop their skills before they get to college? Where are these people's skills coming from?
There's something happening there too. I think, you know, art class in secondary schools are improving, and they're tweaking that, you know, in animation, someone in animation should have a little bit of animation's quality about it, and their portfolio preparations. There's more and more schools in portfolio preparation dealing with animation study there, doing animation studies. So that's prepping up the students quite well as well.
I suppose.
So by that stage, they know they want to do it. They're not going to arrive in and go, holy, you know, God, this is hard work, which is it is.
How many times do I have to draw this circle?
Yeah, I know, yeah, because God knows it is hard work.
Yeah, it is. I suppose it's very different to having a rostrum camera in your shed, you know. You don't need a rostrum rig in the shed.
I didn't have a rostrum camera in the shed. I made a couple of rostrum cameras. I made that one for Etta with Declan. And then I made one for the first studio I had in Dawson Street. And then I made another one for another place. But nowadays, you know, you can shoot a nap on your phone. Yeah. God, you have no idea how amazing that is. Yeah, no, because, like, we didn't have line testers. When I started, there wasn't a line tester. You just had to shoot stuff and hope it worked.
Or
if you had time. Yeah, like, I was producing a minute of animation a week in RTE, and basically I shot it on a Friday between about 8 o'clock and 11 o'clock. I got into the baths in the lab before 12. It came out before 1. And then I brought it to an editor, and if there was a mistake in it, I was in trouble. So you really made sure your animation worked, you know. It was paper cutout animation. It wasn't terribly complicated, but things could go wrong, of course. It was basically the same soundtrack every week, so with a few sound effects pop. Parked into it, but so nowadays I could shoot it, you know, and go, oh, I don't like that, take those frames out and put in something else.
Very interesting. The creative development you're seeing in colleges, do you think if people are coming in with a higher skill set in quotation marks, that they have more room and more freedom to be creative within their 4 years of their bachelor degree?
Well, that's what I think is happening. I think that's what's happening in Dunleary. Dunleary always had a bit of a reputation because of, you know, I used to teach, I still do teach alternative animation, experimental animation with sand and paper cutouts and all that, which you didn't get in the other colleges. And so it always had this, and it's more of a filmmaker's film place. And that's not so true now, but because the other colleges are coming through just as strong, and always did, really. But we're really getting top-notch students, and they're producing, because the equipment is better, they're producing much better work. and we're kicking them off now, to nearly trying to make, I'm sure David Quinn will kick me for saying this, but we're trying to make first year, fourth year, you know? Mm-hmm. That's the way I look at it anyway.
Yeah.
We're trying to get more creativity out of them, and they're rising to it. They're rising to the challenge, and they're producing a 10-second, 15-second piece at the end of their first year, which has got, we could stand up to certainly their pitch at the end of third year for the fourth year films, you mm-hmm. know? And we're looking forward to see what kind of fourth years they make, you know? What kind of work they make in fourth year. I've got a feeling that we're going to get a new wave of animators coming through.
Mm.
That'll be Dunleary specials.
Very good. Mm-hmm. So in your animation toolkit, you know, not the pencil and paper one, the one in your head, you have your problem solving.
Yes.
You have your draftsmanship.
Yeah.
You have your creativity.
Yeah.
Out of the three of them, how would you balance them? Is it about equal? Or is it maybe weighted in favour of one or the other?
Yeah, I don't think the craft is that important. You know, it is great if you're a beautiful animator and do beautiful animation. But, you know, if you're not particularly good, you can make a wonderful film. There's lots of people who have, you know, made a very brutalistic, not bad animation, but brutalistic animation, not beautifully Disney-esque.
Mm.
So basically, it's the story is king. You know, what are you telling and how are you telling it? And how you're telling it is the camera angles and the shots. So that's basic filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the basic problem. Then you decide, well, I'm animating this. So what kind of style do I want it? And how beautiful do I want it? And, or, you know, how flowing is it going to be? Or, you know, and that's all to your own personal taste. But basically, basically it's filmmaking, and the basic filmmaking decisions are you're telling a story with pictures, and you're doing it and you're really editing the pictures in the sequence that draw the people into it, you know.
Okay.
So it's not the craft can come very late, you know. You can make a good animation film out of matchsticks, you know, moving around in a frame. In fact, I've seen that. It was all right.
I was just coming back to me. I think you mentioned matchstick film to me years ago when I was in college. So
yeah, there was a famous Polish guy who came here, and he made a film with matchsticks in it. I think it was called The Arrow.
Okay.
I've forgotten his name. He worked out in Emerald City for a while.
Wow.
Yeah. Till he retired.
Okay. So where would you put yourself in terms of, you know, the triangle, so your problem solving and your draftsmanship and your creativity? Where do you fall in this triangle? Somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, personally?
Yeah.
Yeah, I see myself as a director, you know, and I direct, I've made a lot of live action films too. When I say a lot, about 10.
Mm.
And they're mostly dance films. The odd experimental piece with pixelation, which I guess is animation. Mm-hmm. And I've used some pixelation in some dance films. And that's dance for camera, where people dance in front of a camera,
mm-hmm.
but the camera moves around them. So the camera influences the dance. It's not like capturing a choreographed dance stage piece and trying to capture that dance as they perform it on stage. It's in a special location, and could be outside in a field, on the side of a mountain. It could be in a derelict building, and you have the person trying to get a primitive narrative story, because most people do try to tell a story through dance, and you try to capture that and help that with camera shots. So that's a lot of the work I do, you know, and there is a connection between dance and animation in that you're worrying about weight and movement and timing, you know. They're obsessed by timing, dancers, and of course very often they're working, either if they're modern dancers, they're working to gravity, you know, with gravity. So then one of the first things to learn is learn how to fall. So you get these amazing falls and these amazing physical kind of clashes. Or they're ballerina types and they're trying to defy gravity and sort of leap across the stage with no effort. So it's very, very similar to animation. You're thinking movement and timing and weight. And the other thing I didn't touch on is, and perhaps it's very important, is festival work, you know. You know, there's a whole side of animation that I'm not interested in. Once I make a film, I forget about it, and that's distribution, you know. And it's very, very important for, maybe you should get a distributor in here. I'm trying to think of the guy who set up Monster Animations with Gerard O'Rourke. Fitzpatrick is his second name. We'll have to get his name.
Take a note here.
Yeah, and come back to it and fit it in somehow. But he's a distributor, and you should get him. Anyway, coming back to the story, festivals for me have been very, very important. Like going to the Annecy Film Festival in 1985, way back then. That's the first time I met Jimmy Rocami, was there actually. And just seeing the celebration of films really, really, really appealed to me. And I got involved about 2 or 3 years later setting up the Galway Film Fla. And that first Fla had the first retrospective of Irish animation, or the first meeting of animation professionals, which decided to have that Galway should have a competition. So Galway the second year had the first Irish animation competition. And it also was where the Sniva Flynn came into the meeting and said, "Listen, guys, I found the first animation that was made in Ireland. It was in a garage in Forbo, just 6 miles away or 10 miles away. And we thought at the time it was 1909, but it was Horgan's Clock Tower, which is, according to Yvonne Hennessy, who's an academic in Athlone, specializes in animation. She reckons it's 1919, not 1909. But anyway, the thing of it, and she's right, but the prize is the James Horgan Prize that we established the next year. And so that was very, very animation friendly. It still is, of course. And a lot of the early animators went there and saw their stuff on the big screen. I think that was really important, because I did emphasize animation and the American studios and education, you know, and the young people, and that perfect storm. Part of the perfect storm was the Galway Film Fla, that it really celebrated animation and grew up with animation in Ireland, and a lot of success stories. John McCluskey in Derry, who's got some beautiful, beautiful films, he came down to the Flan and saw animation and went, "Wow, I want to do that," you know, and came back the next year, maybe 2 years later, with a piece, and eventually came back with the first Frameworks ever shown, which was Midnight Dance, and whenever that was, 1996, I think, and 97 maybe, and he won. And so that was the Galway Film Fla was a major, major stepping stone into the industry for a lot of people. So it should get a lot of praise. It's coming up in mid July this year. It always comes up in mid July. But another festival has popped up. There's a couple of all the festivals now have animation prizes, but this Animation Dingle is particularly good launching pad for animators. There's a lot of students orientated around students, and they meet people in the business and get their first start.
There's a first film category down there
as well. They show a lot of student work down there, which is just perfect, you know, seeing it on the big screen and meeting professionals, especially animation professionals, because that's another thing, a lovely thing about Irish, but for animation festivals generally, is there's less BS at it, you know. There's no red carpet and there's no actor pretending that the world revolves around them, you know. And you can sit down in Annecy at a cafe and just talk to somebody, and the next thing you know, they're like two Oscar winners and they're amazing animators, and as modest as the day is long, you know. And it's really, really endearing to meet them, you know. And that had a big effect on me. So I think Dingle is having a lot of effect on people. So good luck to them down there. It's the Jam Media people who really established that.
I have 100 more questions for you, but I'm only going to ask one more because we're kind of coming up on our time. How do you deal with rejection? You've made so many films. I'm sure you got as many no's as you got yeses.
Oh, more.
All right. How do you cope?
Well, what the big growing up companies do, the likes of, they would have 10 pokers in the fire. So you get one rejected, it's like, there's 9 more in there. So that's one way to try to get around it. Have another project ready to go and you just take the hit and, I've just put this one into the Arts Council or the BAI or TG Cow or something like that. And so maybe that'll have the look this one didn't have. So that's one way of dealing with it. I think the other way of dealing with it is to realize there's always somebody with a worse story than you. Because, you know, if you're a filmmaker, you can come up with a film script again and come up with a, you know, storyboard again and draw it. Whereas like actors, you know, they get about 60 rejections a year. To hope maybe 120 and then get one, you know, and get a job every 2 years or something. So they're getting smacked in the face, you know, every week. So really good. I mean, if you're a filmmaker, you're going to get smacked in the face once a year. Well, an independent filmmaker, you know, Frameworks comes around, 50 people put in, 4 or 5 people get it. So 45 people are crying into their tea, you know, that day. But usually, you know, you've got something bubbling away in the background and you sort of fall back on that. You have to give up. I mean, I haven't said that. You know, I'm working on a script at the moment, which I started about 20 years ago and got rejected a few times. And Yeah. So it's never quite dead. It might, if it's a good story, it'll get made. You know, this is a good story, and it might not yet get made. It's a feature, so who knows what'll happen. You know, there's a lot of things could go wrong making a feature. But and I had another film that I made. In fact, it was the last animation I made, which I think was in 2000. It was finished in 2018, and that was about 12 years old, mm-hmm. and had been rejected. And I actually approached T.G. Carr about a dance film, because I want to do something in Irish dance, and I thought they might have some extra money somewhere floating around. And I said, listen, it was Liam O'Malley, and I said, Liam, is there any money floating around? I'll only need $2,000 and I'll shoot some Irish dance. He said, you know, I've always been thinking about that story you told me in the Fla 10 years ago. And I went, oh yeah, the story about the famine, yeah. And he said, write that up. And I did, and I got funded from the BEI on the back of it, yeah. So, yeah, maybe that's something you can cling on to, that it's just, it's time isn't right. You might be able to revisit it. I know Aidan Hickey had a story about that too, about a film that he took down after 10 years. He needed someone saying, please throw in a film. And he took something off the shelf that was up there for 10 years, and bam, he got it made. Mm-hmm. So, so that's another thing you can tell yourself with rejections. There's people getting worse, harder rejections more often than you will. You've always got something in the, you know, cooking in the back somewhere anyway, and that idea just mightn't have been ready for that time, and it might come off the shelf again, you know, so don't throw it away completely.
Okay, great. Keep trying.
Oh, yeah.
There's loads of time.
Yeah, absolutely. Keep trying. That's the name of the game. And also, you're never going to really create the perfect film you ever wanted to either, you know. You'll always need a couple of more days and a couple of more grand, you know, euros, and you know, it never, there's something... That's not true. I'm sure some much better filmmakers than I have produced the vision of their dreams for the budget they had and the time they had. But
finished is better than perfect, and made is better than in the shelf. And
yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much for coming in and talking
very much.
To me. It's been a pleasure.
It was a real pleasure for me too. Thank you very much.
I've learned so much.
It's very kind of you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.